The all-new Hyundai 2024 Santa Fe is equipped with everything that you need to break free from the dull work week and embark on an adventurous weekend with your family. The all-new Hyundai Santa Fe's features like available H-Track all-wheel drive, standard third-row seating, available dual wireless charging pads ensure that you can take on any adventure. Available H-Track all-wheel drive so you can take on the dirt trails and kick up some mud. Standard third-row seating so your whole family can experience the thrill together. Available dual wireless charging pads so no one gets stuck in the great outdoors with a dead phone. I've been so pumped to take a couple of friends with our road bikes to some of the trails nearby, and now I can bring the entire crew, my dog, and all of our gear with that third row. Learn more about the new Hyundai Santa Fe at HyundaiUSA.com. Call 562-314-4603 for complete details. Nah, 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 come on! The Heat Check, we have a very special guest, my guy Jake Fisher. He's an author. Folks don't know, he's written books. He's the author of Built to Lose, How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever. I think that tanking, we'll talk about this another time, but like owners that just try to lose, I just can't stand it. I really can't. He also is a newsbreaker, newsmaker. Currently works for Bleacher Report, has worked for SI, has worked for SB Nation. Actually got his start at the Boston Globe, which I did not know until today. Very Big J journalist Jake Fisher making some moves. Making some moves. Bust out on the scene, Jake Fisher, out of fucking nowhere, too. Just all of a sudden breaking huge news. Welcome to the show, Jake Fisher.
That is a very kind intro. I'd like to think I was like around for a long time. You know, I was picking away with my axe at Slam and SI, but then, you know, all of a sudden we got thrust into this transaction world. So we're trying to make it work, you know.
How did you get into it? Because I feel like you don't just break. I mean, it's not easy to just all of a sudden be developing the relationships where you break news. Did that come from, so this Built to Lose, How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever, did the relationships through that sourcing of that book end up lead you on this path? Was it, like, break down how you got here as, like, cogently as possible.
Well, first of all, thank you for the very seamless and organic plugs of the book title multiple times. My publisher was very grateful for that. But to answer your question, and it's funny, it's honestly the question I typically get the most when I do talk on shows such as these. But I mean, at SI for years, I was writing all these dumb, silly features that people wanted to talk about. Like I got coffee with Mike D'Antoni one day at like 7 a.m. downtown in Fidei at the Starbucks, because apparently he is addicted to Starbucks cappuccinos. It's the only thing that is like close to resembling his time in Milan or all over Italy when he was playing and coaching there professionally, and like stuff like, I mean, there's a lot down the list of those types of like personality type stories. And I got to know people in the league by being someone who wasn't trying to call them about very pressing details such as the ones I'm doing now. But flash forward, I got laid off by Sports Illustrated in October 2019, when the company got taken over by new management, leadership, whatever. And fortunately, my editor at Bleacher Report, Chris Trenchard, I had a relationship with him just being in the industry for a couple years, and he was letting me freelance there. I did some stuff. Like, I remember I did a story about Trae Young before his All-Star game, how he was, like, hanging out with Chris Paul as, like, a high school kid and going to Kevin Durant's apartment to watch TNT Thursday night games when he was 16, 17 years old. I did some feature after the pandemic began about how the teams gearing up to go to the bubble were, instead of high-fiving, they were like tapping each other's feet and sneakers to try to like avoid the germification of, you know, COVID and everything. And then 2021, beginning of that year, my editor Chris said, you know, we kind of need to go away from the freelance stuff and the feature writing that you prefer to do, We want to go into this more transactional game. So to bring a long ramble to a close, I wanted to do it in a way that was storytelling, though. So I do try to write a story every week, and something that I feel like we go back and forth a lot on the edits about trying to what's like relevant, like what's going to be aggregated, and like I am trying to interweave those juicy tidbits within ultimately context, and the context just becomes what I think is more of a narrative in the day-to-day game of this transaction beast.
So how do you get to the point where people are all wanting to answer your calls, like as a new kid on the block? Because I feel like all the things that you were doing and the relationships that you built from feature writing, now it's like, hey, by the way, like I'm just another one of those news leeches. I need info and I need it now.
I mean, the leech thing is funny. Like, I do address the elephant in the room and kind of make fun of it myself when I'm hanging out with people, off the record. I mean, a lot of people do still. I was at dinner with a bunch of people a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, whatever the dates were, down in New Orleans, and some guy kept kind of saying, like, with Jake's here, like, am I going to be some unnamed source? I think you kind of have to steer into that and like recognize the elephant in the room, but also, I mean, I've known a lot of these people now for over, almost a decade. I kind of really started covering the league at the 2013 draft, so it's been a long time for a lot of these guys. People of late, like whenever I meet someone new, fortunately I've found the last 6 to 8, 9 months or so, people kind of know me more now. So when it's an introduction, they're like, "Oh yeah, okay, yeah, I know what you do." And that obviously is a pretty nice lubricant to create a dialogue and a communication. But to get people to give me the info for as to answer your question, like what I do is just, I mean, when I got the kind of quote unquote offer or the positional shift push from my editor, I called like 10, 15 guys in the league that I knew had access to info that I had been talking with for years and said, "Hey, would you mind if I just did this once a week and started badgering you? Like, I know it's going to be annoying, but I promise it'll be like we'll have a good time with it. Like we're friends, or at least we have some type of relationship." And that's kind of where it got started. And every week I make those calls, or and that list has grown and shrunk, and some people fall in and out because of what you write or because of what their boss now doesn't want them to be saying to you. But I think with like the Tibbs story this week, I just had heard that very loosely and then very more strongly. And then, like, I finally gathered all my intel and brought it to the highest ranking people that I could that would truly know. And they kind of confirm or deny the little details. And then we write something up and move on to the next week.
Awesome. That's really interesting. I guess if you're bringing it out into the forefront and saying like, "Hey, I'm going to be scheduling out my times to pester you and to badger you." That's and then they agree. They kind of know what they're signing up for, especially since you've got a pre-existing relationship. What are the do's and don'ts of news breaking? Like, what are things that get you cut off from this business, and what are ways that you think like help you be successful?
That's a great question. And I will say also to kind of bridge us to the last question too. Now also, like, people know that I and for and it's not just me, obviously. I think everything I'm talking in terms of my approach, I can't speak to that. That's what everyone else's approach
Sure,
is
of
as well,
course.
but
That's kind of sort of implied.
for sure. But in terms of like the role that I can play in terms of like not the article, but the actual conversations, like there's a lot of people in the media side of things, but when you have access to information that is considered proprietary in terms of the NBA world, teams do want to know what I know. Like, there's a lot of people who, like, I can help connect the dot to create, so I'm not saying like I'm taking credit for a transaction happening, but that's, I mean, it's not just me. Again, this is what the role that we can provide as a collective of, the reporter in the NBA ecosystem. Like, that's why at the end of the day, people have a general incentive to talk. And I think recognizing that is the biggest to bring us to your second question, I think that's the biggest thing to have in your quiver when you're going into these conversations. Like, if you go into it as, oh yeah, I am just a pest and I'm just coming to be annoying to you, like, that works, I think, to show like humility and the human aspect of the conversation you're having. But if I call someone who, like an agent of a player who is requesting a trade, or a general manager, I'm talking about that team's trade conversations, like, you need to, I think, also kind of hold yourself with an authority and that, like, you have a purpose for that call. Because people will try to bully you and walk over you and lie to you and try to not help you. But if you present things, I think, in a respectful way, in a professional way, in a way that, to not sound too corny, like, means business, I think people will respect that ultimately, and they'll recognize and understand if your story's coming out, their perspective and what they can help to try to shift it in a way that might even benefit them. It's also your job to be thinking all the time what these people's motivations are and where they're hoping to get the story to be, and why they might be saying that, or where they might know that information from. There's a lot of, like, second guessing, I think, you have to do in your head all the time to try to separate the fact from the fiction, because the NBA is, I'm sure the NFL and baseball are very similar, but the NBA ecosystem is very much rooted in rumor. And a lot of it isn't true, but a lot of it is coming from something that is true. So if you can peel back through all the bullshit and figure out the truth, you can kind of write something and write some tea leaves to things that are going to happen when, then ultimately they do get reported someday.
Are there things you should not do? Like, say you're at that dinner. Like, do those people do become unnamed sources if they're sort of casually mentioning that? Or is that the first breadcrumb that you end up using to then go in a more formal basis to say, okay, like, I can go and call up a contact and confirm this to be the case?
Well, the general don't do's, I mean, like, if you are going to be a narc, like, if everything people say to you is going to be written publicly, or you're going to be then spewing it and telling everyone that you talk to, like, no one's going to want to talk to you anymore. I mean, there's a fine line between, like, obviously when I'm talking to people, like, everything I'm hearing is ultimately coloring my overall understanding to make my stories more accurate and more authentic and more knowledgeable. But at the same time, like, you can write something that's very honestly damning about someone or a team, but also kind of leaving out a lot of details that might not necessarily be necessary or might not be confirmed, but you can kind of characterize them in ways that also can help a relationship continue, but also are still being fair and critical at the same time. Like, I think there is a balance in that. And I think to your second part of that question, like, how do you switch, make that switch flip to someone you can call? I mean, to me, like, anybody is someone I can call, like, especially coming from the perspective of, like, to do my job as well as I can, trying to get as much of the truth as I can, and the best way to do that is to talk to literally everybody. So if that's the case, then I can call everybody. In terms of someone who I know wants to talk and whisper, and everyone wants to talk about other people, right? Those people that I can have those powwows with on a semi-weekly basis. You can tell pretty quickly right away. Sometimes people are very straight up about it, kind of like out of a TV show, and, I can help you can help me. Like, here's my card. Let's stay in touch. Like, sometimes that is very, it is very, like, there's a, sw there's, it's kind of like on a date where you're having a good conversation. All of a sudden, the conversation switches, and you're like, okay, like, I'm probably going to kiss this person now. Obviously, the metaphor is whatever, but
Right.
it is very similar. It really is.
Interesting. You talked about a couple of things. You talked about the Tibbs news. That's been fascinating too. We'll switch gears now into kind of like the brass tacks, I guess, of the NBA team, because I think everyone's been wanting to know what's going on with the Knicks. Everyone's wanting to know how could a new management team come in, hand select the guy, that guy end up winning Coach of the Year, taking a team that hasn't been to the playoffs in God knows how long to the four seed, getting home court advantage, obviously flaming out to a team that overperformed, right? And then a year later, after a lot of the moves that he wanted the management to make did not get made, guys that come in that are very clearly not Tibbs guys, like not defensive guys, say like Evan Fournier, say like Kemba Walker, and then a couple of key injuries, how one could see that management team who hand-selected Tibbs going away from him and firing him so early on in his contract. Can you just kind of shed light on that evolution and then how like maybe this team and how they've been performing late changes, maybe the trajectory of where they go with Tibbs?
Yeah, I think ultimately from my understanding, I don't think his job ever really was in jeopardy, being that, as I wrote yesterday and as I'll definitely say now, like, it seems pretty clear Leon Rose has never had any intention of making a change at his bench. And honestly, I've kind of dipped off Twitter a bit in the New York world for the last couple of weeks, months. Like when I put that story out, I was honestly genuinely surprised how many Knicks fans were not happy with that news. Being that I live here in Brooklyn, like a couple months ago, I mean, that Bing Bong night feels very, very, very recent, right? And that was still so fresh off that playoff run. That even after they flamed out with Atlanta, like, the Garden was back, the city was rocking, and like, Tibbs was the guy. And it's really crazy how quickly the fans can shift gears. And it's important because in a city like New York and in many cities, When the fans turn the tide to some degree that loudly, it can absolutely get back to ownership, which changes the direction of what management wants to do, sometimes for worse. And I think it is important to recognize here that as much as James Dolan's gotten his flack over the years, I do think what I've heard, and it's been pretty consistent over my career, he seems to give his management free rein to do as they do please, which is what I reported this week, that basically the word I got was that, ownership, I don't know if it was Dolan specifically, but gave permission, do what you want. If you want to keep him, great. If you don't, find a new guy, that's fine too. So that's at least interesting, but that also maybe might not be interesting at all, being that that's obviously just generally how it's gone. I think to the roster point of it all, that's kind of been the biggest dynamic, I think, and also being that time and again, even last year, like during the regular season, teams that would lose to the Knicks. Like, I remember Minnesota one time, I was talking to some guys on that staff after they lost to the Knicks, and they were saying, like, they beat you up and we're playing 4 and 5 nights, and they don't, like, there are nights where you want to let go of the rope because it's just the Tibbs defense coming at you in the shortened year, COVID, shortness with these weird roster crunches and all that type of stuff. They claw their way to the 4 seed. Julius Randle has his career year that a lot of people in the Knicks organization were already saying back then, this is not going to be replicable. There are people with the Knicks at the time who were, I mean, and still to this day, in New York, who were saying that, he's not worth that contract. We should even consider looking to trade him at that deadline. That conversation happened. I definitely have written this, but they never really did really entertain that. Julius was their guy they wanted to reward. He was the kind of focal point that was going to lift them continually to the playoffs, and maybe someone like Dame was going to want to come, right? That was kind of the goal, and obviously we are not there right now, so I recognize why fans would want to have a drastic change here, but everything I've heard, it seems like coach and front office are still generally on the same page, and they recognize the roster is flawed. They've got things to adjust and really restructure this summer. And I do think they're going to try to be very active in doing so. I don't want to say that there's going to be a lot of activity, though, definitively, because they seemed very destined to do that at the deadline, and as I wrote also yesterday, the way the Knicks apparently operate as a front office in these negotiations, they get a little picky. And no pun intended, but they really want extra draft picks all the time in all these deals. And it's apparently led to a lot of these trade talks falling apart. So if that continues in the offseason, I wonder how successful they actually will be in really retooling this roster.
Do you think agents, like as a general rule, make great front office members? Because it feels like agents want to just, and you've got a bunch of examples of it not being great. You got one example, obviously, of it going really well with Bob Myers and Golden State. But, like, it feels like agents always want to squeeze out every last drop that they can to the detriment of maybe harmony between the fraternity in the NBA. And now you've got guys coming from CAA, right? Leon Rose has been doing this a long time, World Wide West, who I consider sort of like from above the clouds. Like, you don't, he's got a tower like villain, like castle in the sky. And he's like looking down. Yes. And like nobody really sees him or knows what he's up to, but he's kind of got his fingers and everything. Do you think that's something that we're going to see moving forward? Do you think that actually like makes sense?
I mean, no, I don't. And I don't want to speak like so definitively on it because A, the Lakers, you know, Rob Pelinka won a championship, and it's been 2 years since Leon took over in New York. So if I learned anything like over my years covering team building and the book reporting, I think it's important to consider the fact that like a lot of times something happens for good and for bad that you didn't expect to happen, and all of a sudden like you're Memphis and you have Ja Morant and you're set for the next decade, right? So like if the Knicks somehow win the number one pick this year, right? Like, wow, the garden looks a lot different, you know? So like, I don't want to definitively say that and the Lakers, of course, like we already talked about, won a title and they still got LeBron. Like they got a lot of options on the table this summer. Like, who's to say what those guys can't continue to accomplish, but it hasn't seemed to be a smooth process and a smooth transition, being that both those tenures have clearly been riddled with drama and a little bit of chaos and confusion and deals falling short. And again, the Lakers won the title, but like at the time of the Anthony Davis trade and still today, people on the league always talk about that being an overpay, and that David Griffin did a pretty solid job in getting a strong haul when like there was no other option. Like, he wanted to go to the Lakers. The Lakers wanted him. Like, they didn't really have a need, and you know, they did stuff to kind of sabotage Boston being a real player to go trade for him and stuff like that. Like, there was no need for the Lakers to have to pay that much, but they did. And so you take your hat off to the Pelicans, but also you raise an eyebrow a bit at the Lakers for that. So to answer your question, it's just, I think a lot of these teams want to bring on these player rep type guys, these Nike people, to try to, you know, play this player movement game. But the apparel game and the agent game to sign players, sometimes it's just about how much money you can give them. And in the NBA, everyone can pay each other the same amount, and the incumbent team can pay them more. So now, like, in this, you know, no holds barred game, like, you're all of a sudden stripped of your biggest weapon. How good are you as an operator now? I think that's what it really comes down to.
Yeah. You mentioned David Griffin's kind of led me to my next thought around the Knicks, and I guess where we're at with a team that all of a sudden has gone from being very, very bad to being like much better than we expected them to be in the Pelicans, to the point where I wonder whether a guy who's, you know, had like a Sam Bowie career so far, a Greg Oden-like career so far in terms of the amount of games that he's played, and a lot of that being spurred by issues with conditioning and his weight, and that's obviously Zion, right? So, like, if you're the Pelicans and if you're the Knicks, you know, what happens to, like, in your, what you've kind of talked about and seen, like, what do you think happens to Zion?
Yeah. I mean, what I've learned is that predicting the next revolution of that situation is a fool's errand. But I do think, I mean, the overall context right now is that they're hurtling towards this extension, right? And, you know, will he take the qualifying offer? No one's ever done it, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I think I'd be surprised if that didn't happen, right? Like, it'd be historic for him to do so, and this season has only made his, you know, you just mentioned Sam Bowie and Greg Oden, right? Like, if I'm Zion Williamson, I'm taking as much money as I can get right now, guaranteed long term. I mean, I think that would be conventional wisdom at this point, right? So that's the case when that clearly benefits New Orleans to some degree if they want to even continue to be building around him, which people have posed. But come on, like, when this guy's been healthy, he's been why you took Greg Oden and Sam Bowie at number one or number two, wherever Sam Bowie went. So, it seems thorny, but at the end of the day, like, they built this team now with CJ McCollum and Brandon Ingram, and Jonas Valanciunas is having a career season, and they've got these young wing pieces. Herb Jones might be like one of the better rookie. I mean, him and Matisse Thybulle just came in of late and have been like two of the greatest defensive rookie wings like of all time, literally. So you throw those guys in, and I mean, they seem to be a team that should absolutely be right with Minnesota in terms of like the back half of these like young up and coming playoff teams now. So honestly, this could be a situation, I think, where we look back on, again, the health is obviously the massive big question mark, but you know, we were having those conversations about Joel Embiid at some point too, and look where Philadelphia is. So if Zion can have a similar bounce back, and obviously different injuries, different people, different circumstances, you know, who's to say the Pelicans can't be, if they make the play-in tournament, like that'll be a quote-unquote postseason appearance, like who's to say they can't be back in the postseason next season and even raised up a little bit level with Zion in the fold. Like, I think that's very much on the table still.
You mentioned also, you wrote about this recently, is all this Lakers drama. I don't know where they go. Like, I'm just thinking about, I talked about this on the podcast earlier this week, and like, I'm probably more on the, like, on the cynical alarmist side. That's probably mm-hmm. why I would be a horrible newsbreaker, because I just see like tea leaves in a way, and I'm very skeptical. You've got only three ways you can really make moves, right? You've got the draft, which they don't have no damn draft picks. You've got free agency, but they don't have any cap space. And then you've got trades, right? And then you have to have assets, obviously, to make a deal and to trade that matches salaries and that it makes sense for people. And a lot of times draft picks come in to those trades, which is a very, like you said, thorny situation is probably the best way or the most like optimistic way to say it. To me, it only feels like there's one real asset that that has any likelihood, even if it's very little. Like, I think Russ obviously is difficult to trade. That's a negative trade asset right now, given all of the lowlights that we're seeing. I mean, guys are just making fun of him out there. Like, they're just literally clowning him in the media, on Twitter, on the court, in press conferences. The amount of money is obscene. Like, to me, it feels like the only real asset to make this team better, if you actually want to win a championship, is to trade Anthony Davis. It's the only piece that you have. Am I wrong to believe that that's really the only asset that could be moved for something of value?
Well, I do think that, I mean, Talen Horton-Tucker was involved in a lot of conversations at the deadline. And, you know, as I put in that Knicks story, to be very synergetic here, I do think that three-team deal with Toronto and New York would have gone down if the Knicks didn't. And that's what I've heard from several accounts, that the Knicks asking for more draft capital was what ultimately had that deal fall short. So I do think Talen still has his fans around the league. I mean, Malik Monk will definitely not be.
And to recap for folks who didn't read the article, what was the deal?
I'm going to botch it completely off the top of my head, but it was definitely Talen Horton-Tucker and Nerlens Noel would have been in Toronto. Alec Burks and Cam Reddish, I believe, would have gone to the Lakers, and Goran Dragic and at least the Raptors' first-round pick, that package that went to Toronto, would have gone to New York. And the Knicks, from what I was told, were looking for more picks after that. I mean, it wouldn't have been a dramatic increase for the Lakers, I don't think. I mean, Alec Burks would have been a nice little ball-handling addition, but, I mean, to what degree Cam Reddish – I don't know what he is really in terms of a consistent rotation player. I don't think anyone really does, honestly. And that's why he wanted to get traded out of Atlanta, right, to have that type of consistent playing time. So to bring it back to the Lakers, like, don't know how much that would have done for them. And the Anthony Davis thing, when I wrote a big takeout thing on the Lakers 2-3 weeks ago, I was surprised to see Lakers fans' reactions, how many of them wanted them to look into trading AD. I was. I don't think that's even remotely going to be considered from everything I've been told. And not just for the clutch dynamic of it all, but I just think, Like, they traded all that stuff to New Orleans that we talked about to pair LeBron and Anthony Davis together. And when they were healthy and really consistent, they won the title. So, I mean, people with the Lakers still talk about right now to this day. Maybe it's changed in the last 3 days or so, but they're still singing the same tune of if we're healthy, no one's going to want to see us, all that jazz. So, I mean, if they can pull some magic this summer with a deadline trade or whatever, a draft type trade or whatever, I'm not so sure. To me, with LeBron's extension thing coming up, I've been saying this in conversations with people on the league the last couple of days. I wonder how him and his people will respond if they hear this podcast. But if I'm LeBron, I'm taking a pay cut. I think that would dramatically help the Lakers situation and help them add flexibility. I mean, Brady did that in New England. I believe he did it in Tampa Bay. I think Peyton Manning did it in Denver. Like, honestly, that guy, and you take your hat off to him for building a global entity around himself. He's a billionaire. So, you know, we're all whispering about what team he's going to ultimately try to buy. Is it going to be this potential Vegas, you know, addition or another team that, like, which team could get sold upcoming here? Like, if that's the case, why does he need the max? Like, why can't he take 10, 15 million and create maybe even a max space to go sign somebody to come join them? You know, like, that's honestly something that I think should be talked about. If I'm in the Lakers world, I don't know if that's possible at all, but I do know that I think it's very unlikely Anthony Davis gets moved.
Yeah, because it feels like that's the only other option too, right? When you talk about roster construction and how much money they're spending, and they've got a bunch of guys on minimum contracts, and that's just not getting it done. I think if you're honest with yourself and you truly actually want a ring and you want to get more championships, which is kind of the whole goal of this, not just to have a bunch of clutch clients playing with one another in purple and gold, to because there's a lot of people who are going to throw shade at Anthony Davis for that ring because they're calling it the A Disney-like bubble ring. Right, to have a legitimate ring in an 82-game season when you're on the road and have no asterisks around it, there's got to be something.
Oh,
yeah, I don't think that's being considered right now. It's not me who's saying that, but there's fans who call it the asterisk ring.
Yeah, they do. I'm not saying that. Please,
I'm not saying it either.
But no, I think
I'm not.
I mean, I understand why, being that ultimately he has not performed to that degree since the bubble. Like, it's been clear. I mean, TJ Warren hasn't either. The Suns, I think, are the only team that's really, like, bottled up what they had down there and took it. I mean, Miami's kind of back being number one seed in the East, right? But, the bubble was an interesting subnote or footnote in the subtext of NBA history. Definitely interesting.
For sure. And when you're 28 and your nickname is Street Clothes and you've got Achilles tendinosis, which is a degenerative condition, it's very difficult. It's a precarious spot.
You're talking about me or AD, because I am 28 with Achilles tendinosis. So,
are you really?
Yeah.
What is newsbreaker Jake Fisher and Anthony Davis? Two guys that are 28.
Dog before I play pickup. A lot of downward dog before I play pickup, yeah. Okay.
So you're saying that the only way, I guess, that the Lakers can actually make a real title run is for LeBron to take a pay cut.
I'm not saying the only way, but I think it would help them a lot. I think that would clearly give them a lot more flexibility.
You did a piece on Zach LaVine, another guy who I think is playing out of his mind when healthy. Chicago, awesome. Definitely beneficiaries of the Lakers being cheap and not wanting to pay Alex Crusoe.
Yeah.
I mean, they are. I mean, watching, as a very quick aside, watching Winning Time, which is causing obviously a lot of stirs people who are living in historical land.
Yeah, I saw the pilot at All-Star. And I mean, in the author community, you know, Jeff Perlman is a whale in the sports world. So I shot him a DM after the premiere, and I said, or I guess it was like a soft premiere. I said, this is gonna be big. And he said, thank you, man. Like, why do you, like, blah, blah, blah. It's definitely, yeah. they do not pull any punches in that storytelling, that is for sure.
No, people, I hit up some people that covered the league during that era, and they were not happy. They said they would not watch it. They were not happy with the historical storytelling. Some of the details around, of course, Jerry West, were people were very upset mm-hmm. about. So, but when I watched it, though, I think the thing that stuck out was how committed Dr. Buss was to making a team mm-hmm. to making a team a contender no matter what. And I said when I watched yeah. episode 1-2, he would roll in his grave with this Alex Caruso stuff. It's
like... Yeah, no. I mean, look, a constant thing you hear in conversations around the NBA is that it all starts with ownership, right? And, like, I mean, Mark Cuban is, you know, considered to be this really competitive, bloodthirsty, wannabe champion. I'm not saying he's a wannabe champion, he's a champion, he won a championship, but someone yeah. who wants to be a champion year after year after year, there are teams who aren't, right? Mark Cuban doesn't pay the tax. Like, I mean, I'm not saying I mean, he's proven a willingness to do so when it came up, but like, there are a few teams like Golden State and Brooklyn that are paying absorbent amounts of tax every single year to go get this done. I mean, the Clippers are obviously going to continue to spend and spend and spend. It's a real factor in, you know, this arms race that ultimately the title ends up becoming.
Do you think Chicago falls into that? Because they haven't in the past been excited about overpaying mm-hmm. or paying fair value over the course of history, even when they had Michael Jordan, right? And yeah. now Zach LaVine has made it very clear to the world, not just last year, but this year, I'm a max player. I'm not going yeah. to accept less than the very maximum that I can make. Yeah. And now he's getting, like, PRP in his knee. He's got inflammation in his knee. And you're paying a shitload of money to everyone, including Vooch. Like, what do you
– Yeah.
Do you think there's any possibility? You did an awesome feature on him, too, by the way. I like that piece a lot.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a rare opportunity of the last 2 years to actually sit down with a player face-to-face and have a conversation. It was – what a novel concept. It was – I mean – that's something I really miss. And I think it's one part of this whole transaction world that I'd be curious what my job would be like if I was then, you know, going to someone at shoot around and saying, hey, this is what I'm hearing about you, and get their point. But he's been very clear, like you said, that, I mean, he clearly views himself as one of these top guys, and he has performed as such. I think, you know, the Bulls have obviously made move after move after move to kind of win now and build a thing around him to get him into the postseason, to show him they're a place to stick around with. But also at the time, like a couple years ago, they also wanted to see him in that environment and see if he could get to that level. I think that question, those questions have already been solved, and clearly they're throwing out 3-year, $80 million plus deals to DeMar DeRozan in his 30s. Like, they're willing to spend the Lonzo contract. LaVine's deal is going to be well over $200 million, regardless of if he gets that All-NBA team. Vooch's contract comes off the books, I believe, after next season, and they're already starting to – I mean, any smart front office is doing this. They're already starting to kind of hash some backup plans and who could we maybe bring in, who could be a backup for him next year but could be the starter after, like that type of stuff. I mean, I think – Arturis Karnisovas up top and from Mark Eversley on down, like that staff is pretty filled out with people who are highly respected around the league. And Arturis comes from Denver most recently, Houston before that, you know, teams that really combine all facets of the team building dynamics where, you know, the draft is important, trade and free agency is important. They've really flexed their muscles in all three of those categories in their tenure there. So, I mean, the IO pick of late obviously stands out to me recently. I mean, Patrick Williams is someone that they kind of targeted pretty quickly, and he's a darling around the league. So, yeah, to answer your question, if the success comes, like clearly they've shown a ceiling now, we'll have to see when they're fully healthy in the postseason. If this team at least wins one round, like I think obviously the excitement in Chicago from where the team's been of late will be pretty significant. If they can continue to move forward, and if they can continue to be a real threat in the East, which, I mean, everyone in the East that I talk to in terms of executives and coaches among those top teams, they view Chicago as dangerous a threat as anybody. So if that continues, I think the Bulls will pay. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting too because they might end up having to play Boston in the first round, and Boston is a buzzsaw right now. That is a series I think a lot of people want to see, and maybe at that point your expectations are just compete on a very high level with Boston, given the fact that we haven't been healthy all year. I'm hearing there's takes. I'm hearing there's some Jake's takes. You're not just a newsbreaker. You're not just a newsmaker. You have opinions, which is probably incredibly difficult in this space. We've talked about this before. I lead with takes, and then it's usually substantiated by mostly like things, very little things that I hear, and a lot of Jake Fisher type reporting. So I just remember all the things that you've written over the course of time, and those prior to
you're very good on the show, just dropping my dossier throughout the whole time here. So you did your homework clearly.
You know, here's the thing: I respect the hell out of you when you came out. The one thing that I would say that, as just a quick aside, that is the most suspect thing you've ever written is when there was clearly a hit piece being written about Nate Bjorkgren. It wasn't yours, but you could tell it was like there was some stuff going on behind the scenes to like take him out. And do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I mean, so my recollection of that was that, I mean, around the deadline, the talk was starting that, like, oh, the Nate Bjorkgren thing in Indy's bad. And I remember telling my editor, like, I don't want to be the bad guy. Like, I don't want to be the first person to say this guy's going to get fired after a year for being, by all accounts, a lunatic. I mean, I don't want to. That's what everyone was saying, you know? So I knew that other people, let's say, weren't going to write the full details. And yes, there is a series of events where one person tweeted something out very briefly on Monday night, and then another story came out on Tuesday that had a little bit more details, and then my story came out on Wednesday that was like 2,000 words about it. Those details that I had been working on quietly, and honestly, I will say, seeing Tim Cato and Sam Amick write the Dallas stuff about Haralabob before all that whole situation blew up, that honestly pushed me. I was like, man, I should have just written that Bjorkgren stuff first. And it definitely got, I mean, it took on a life of its own. But yes, continue with whatever you were.
Anyway, but you're not just a newsbreaker, a newsmaker. I'm hearing that there are takes. So you've come prepared with things, the opinions. We don't know which direction that they're going, so I'm just going to kind of like, what are some things that grind your gears that you have some strong opinions about around the NBA?
All right. They're all general, and this first one's not that controversial, but you got to get rid of the block charge. It is the dumbest rule possible. It's not a basketball play. When I play basketball as a 28-year-old with Achilles tendinosis, no one's taking a charge. Because no one wants to get hurt because we're not getting paid for it. And you know what? The game is fine and it's better. And we don't have to worry about, like, when you're driving and then you pass it to someone in the corner and then you no longer have the ball in your hands and you take two steps because you have momentum and you just run into someone who's just standing there. That's not a foul. That's just someone walking in front of you wanting to get hit. Like, that's not – that guy who's doing that should go play football or lacrosse. That's not what basketball is. That's my first take.
I'm
gonna
like
keep
that.
Going, or you got? You
yeah,
got
to go. I actually like that take. I think it's super whack, especially down the stretch. Like when you see guys very clearly, they're planning to kick out, and then they make contact. I don't think that should be a block or a charge. Like I hate it when it's a block more, because it's like I don't know why this guy's getting credit for this at all whatsoever. I agree. There's another rules change. Is this the second one, a rules change?
No, this is an NBA branding thought.
All right.
All the jerseys, it's gotten to a point where it's horrific. Like, really, really bad. I found out recently that in a G League game, two teams walked out, both wearing white jerseys lately. Like, I mean, we're in this situation where, like, every team gets five new jerseys every year. The Heat have this, like, weird thing where, and the Cavs, too, where every letter is different from the other
looks
one.
Looks like a ransom note.
This is an obvious money grab. Yeah, it looks like a ransom note. It's an obvious money grab. I think it really ruins, like, cultural development of, like, a pride thing with that team, because you don't – like, I remember when I was visiting college campuses in high school, like, my guidance counselor said, like, when you're walking around, the schools that are always wearing their school stuff, like, that's how you know the people there are, like, happy and like their school. So, like, if you're walking around town and, like, I don't know. When I see orange, I don't, like, just orange and, like, black. Like, I don't necessarily think Nick. Maybe that's a bad example. I don't know. But, like, the Timberwolves lime green jerseys are an eyesore. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know.
How about the Thunder blue Bucks don't have ones? Any... They're, like, the terrible.
Yeah. So,
yeah, the Cream City.
I'm over all the jerseys. Yeah, maybe have just, like, one new one every year, or, like, one new alternate, and, like, one holiday, whether it's, like, they're on Christmas, or, like, those St. Paddy Day's jerseys that used to come up, like, those Green Bulls ones, like, maybe that, or, like, and you wear your Christmas jersey not just on Christmas, like, a couple of, like, the Christmas season, you know, time, and maybe there's, like, you know, the Hawks have a cool MLK Day jersey, maybe there's, like, a one holiday that every team has. Or maybe the Heat and the Suns and teams and who all do the Latin American, you know, Heritage Night jerseys that have pretty high Latin American population in their cities. Like, maybe that's their alternate, but we can't have 5-6 alternates every year. Can't have it. It's too much.
I saw this digital Paisanos on the floor at Chase Center. It's a digital ad on the floor, digital. And it's, okay. Was it for the NBC Sports Washington Wizards versus Warriors? And it was a Wizards, it was like a DC Italian restaurant. Probably paid $10 for that ad, max. And like when you walk over it, your feet go digital too.
Yeah.
I hate that.
Yeah.
That should not be okay.
It first happened in the bubble because they had to do that for all the local RSNs. But they only had like 3 courts. Yeah. No, it's – and I remember Kia was advertising on the playoffs, but they changed their logo. And I remember me and my roommate trying to figure out what the company was because we couldn't recognize the new Kia logo, which I think is obviously the opposite of what advertising's goal is.
And team take. You have a team take?
I do, but I have one more other one quickly.
Okay.
There should be a stat when you drive to the basket and it's like you get by somebody, not like you're just there. Like you actually make a move, you create an opportunity for yourself, and you miss, but someone then has an easy putback. There should be a stat for that. I checked with a couple analytics friends on the league. There is not. That should be a registered, accounted skill.
What do you think that would be called? Like a...
No idea.
Like a like miss a drive assist? Yeah, assist.
Yeah, a miss assist. I don't know. Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, you could add that in like whip in baseball.
Yeah. And my team take is that I think the Celtics are a legitimate contender to win the title.
What a hot take that is. That a hot take.
I don't think it's that hot, but...
They're 40. Yeah. No, it's not. They're 40 to 1 to win it all right now. They are
pretty blown away by how good they are. Like I'm pretty blown away by how good they are. There was all this talk in December. Oh, it's not going well. Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, one's getting traded, and now it's like, wow, the Celtics are a juggernaut. That team's not going anywhere. Everyone's untouchable. Like it's changed pretty quickly.
It's crazy how fast like Marcus Smart's return into that lineup. Who was? Mm-hmm. Essentially a liability offensively a ton. Just his return, like they just all of a sudden just started sharing the ball a lot. They're playing elite defense. I want to say like top 2 defense in the league since that time period. Just clamping teams. I don't actually know what happened. Maybe just integrating the things that Ime wanted to do and they actually just started executing it. Making a couple of moves, you know, with Derek White, obviously, that helps. And the emergence of Robert Williams. It went from, you know, what it led me to believe is, how, like, or think about is how many teams are closer than we think. to being good.
Hmm.
Because they were a disaster.
They were a disaster.
They were a disaster last year, for sure.
I think.
And like Al Horford, I didn't think he would be helpful really either.
He's been great. I think.
Yeah.
I think ultimately that like, what is the recipe to springing into success after being pretty poop is to have talent. And that's ultimately why we're in this league where the Sixers are trading Ben Simmons for James Harden and teams are tanking and, you know, Russell Westbrook's getting traded to the Lakers and all that stuff. Because, like, when you have all-stars who are playing at the peak of their powers, like, stuff just gets done. And they've got Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. And Tatum clearly looks like to be taking even another leap as a general offensive, you know, central hub of a team. And the defense surrounding that has been what it's been. Jaylen Brown is still an all-star level player. Derek White addition, Marcus Smart. Like, it's just same thing with Phoenix, right? Like, Devin Booker took that leap, and they bring on Chris Paul, and here they are. Like, it's not really that surprising, I think, when you've got talent and depth and defense and shooting.
Yeah. I can't let you go before I ask you my resident Brooklyn Nets.
Okay.
Will we see Kyrie play home games? Because it doesn't feel right now, based on the laws needing to change, that we will. And two, like, how concerning is everything going on with Ben Simmons' back, given his injury history?
Yeah. The back, obviously, you know, I think people were looking at it skeptically at first as like, oh, it's just a reason to not play in that March 10th game. I mean, it's something that's plagued him back to Philly. And from what I was told by someone very close to the situation, as long as they're telling me the truth, this will be accurate, that he was on the court with Nash going well, and then he tweaked something, and it was a setback, essentially. And that's why these teams always talk about, you know, ramping up. Like, I really don't think it's bullshit. Like, I think teams take, like, working out, playing with Deontay Christmas in a high school gym is, like, they take that very differently than NBA game action, and as they should. So I'm not sure where his status stands right now. I haven't checked in with anybody about it recently, but the last I was told was that, like, they really do only truly want him to be ready for April. So I think that calculus clearly won't and will not change, that they just want to be as cautious and safe as they can in terms of ramping him back up to playing. Because, yeah, I don't know if Kyrie Irving is going to be able to play home games this year. At this point, you know, the city, I mean, there's starting to be this discussion of, oh, well, the Yankees, will them coming back, will that have an added boost to, you know, Kyrie's plight here of trying to make a special exemption, quote unquote, for him or for anybody? But I mean, the city just fired over 1,000 more employees over not getting the vaccine, and lifting the mask mandate is way different than lifting the vaccine mandate. I think the mask mandate being lifted was part of, like, the goal of the city to encourage people to get vaccinated, to try to urge us back more to normalcy. So I was starting to think that, oh yeah, now that Kyrie's pulling the stunt and going, and which was a stunt. Like, I'm not saying that in any derogative way. Like, it was a stunt to go to Barclays Center and sit courtside and be maskless as a well-known unvaccinated person. So I guess I don't know what the vaccine requirement situation is if he was allowed in. It's the whole thing is obviously so murky. But I don't think anything is going to change in terms of what the city and the mayor are going to do to allow him to play basketball games anytime soon. If Brooklyn continues to go further into the playoffs, if they're playing in May and June somehow with him only going at away games, maybe that can change. But at this point, like, I don't think there's any optimism that's gonna happen anytime in the near future.
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting, because they were optimistic at one point, because I think they thought that when the vaccination requirements changed for people who came in to watch the game, that would change for him as well. And then obviously visiting teams that are non-vaccinated can play as well. So the logic doesn't necessarily really correlate to the fact that a whole law has to change and thousands of people are being let go because of said law. And if you change the law, then what do you do with those people?
Yeah, and he's a millionaire who really theoretically could change this by just getting the shot. So, and I'm not going to tell anyone to do what to do, but that's a clear, easy solution if the Nets and Kyrie do want him to play home games.
Yeah. Well, awesome stuff. We got you out in the time period that I was hoping to get it out under. You're always insightful. Yeah. We got to do this more. You know, let's test this out. So, Jake, I would like to I don't have any interest in breaking any news, but I would like to regularly pester you. Is it okay if I call you on the phone? We have some regularly pestering type conversations. Is that is that okay with you?
Let's do it. I think we spent some time creating the commensurate relationship to do that. I enjoy talking with you. Let's catch up.
Awesome. Thanks so much to Jake Fisher. Definitely check his book out, Built to Lose, How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever. Also, if you want to find him on Twitter, he's Jake L. Fisher with a C, F-I-S-C-H-E-R. So definitely check him out there. Not as much of an active tweeter as I would like, but he is a writer as well. So check his work out on Bleacher Report, and we'll definitely have to have you on again soon.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.